Welcome to Washington Today for January 10th, 2022. I'm Gary Starikoff. Thanks a lot for joining us this afternoon. For the first time this year, the House and Senate are both back in session. The Senate came back last week, the House gaveling in Monday night. And on Friday, House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer announced new health and safety measures for all members while in the Capitol building due to the increase in COVID-19 cases. Leader Hoyer said the House will lengthen voting times, limit the number of votes taken on the floor, and limit congregating on the House floor and in the surrounding areas during votes. According to a report today from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, nearly 700 people were killed in major weather and climate disasters in the United States last year. Those events cost a total of $145 billion. The agency has been measuring billion-dollar disasters since 1980 and said it's seen a steep increase in frequency, cost, and deaths over the past 5 years. Moderna CEO Stéphane Bancel said his company will begin clinical trials soon on a COVID-19 booster shot that would target the Omicron variant. Meanwhile, Pfizer CEO Albert Bourla said his company would have a vaccine ready to target Omicron, ready by March. We begin on Capitol Hill, where voting rights continue to be the main topic in the Senate. On Friday, Majority Leader Chuck Schumer urged his Democratic colleagues to pass a three-bill package on voting rights without Republican support. But according to Alexander Bolton of The Hill, quote, Democrats are heading toward their own reckoning with their own caucus over the 60-vote legislative filibuster, which Republicans have used to block two sweeping election bills and a separate voting proposal named after the late Republican late Representative John Lewis. Democrats could change the filibuster rules on their own, but Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, both Democrats, continue to withhold support for doing exactly that for a voting rights bill while leaving it in place for other issues. Here's Majority Leader Schumer earlier today.
The Republican leader has pointedly repeated to the experience of the 2020 election as proof somehow that there exists no effort to suppress the vote. But he ignores that the problem today is not just about what happened during the 2020 election, it's about what's happened after and is happening today. If Leader McConnell doesn't want to get into specifics about the laws passed by Republican legislators across this country to limit the right to vote, then we Democrats will. Despite the fact that the 2020 election was free, fair, and accurate, in the year that followed, at least 19 states suddenly decided to rewrite the rules that govern the way people vote in their respective states. At least 33 new laws have passed across the country that will make it harder to vote, harder to register to vote, and worst of all, potentially empower partisans to arbitrate outcomes of future elections instead of nonpartisan election workers. And that may be just the beginning, because legislatures in various states are preparing new laws as they enter the 2022 sessions of their legislatures. I ask my Republican colleagues, take a look at what's happened in many of the Republican-led state legislatures. When Republicans in states like Texas reduce polling hours and polling locations, how does that not make it harder for people to vote? When Republicans in states like Florida, Kansas, Iowa, and Texas make it harder for people to even register to vote, how is that not suppressing their fundamental right to vote at all? What does that have to do with election security? When Republicans in states like Georgia, Indiana, and Florida cut back on the number and availability of locations where people can drop off their absentee ballots, how can Republicans say that voting hasn't been made harder? And when Republicans in states like Georgia make it a crime to give food and water to people waiting in line at the polls, how is that not making it harder for them to cast a ballot? Some of the examples are especially egregious. According to one recent report, Lincoln County in Georgia is looking to eliminate all but one polling location in the entire county before the next election. One location in a whole big county. That is disgusting.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer during leader time on the Senate floor. Voting rights also on the mind of Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. He sent a letter to his Republican colleagues on Sunday that said Democrats will, quote, try to use fake hysteria to break the Senate and silence millions of Americans' voices so that they can take over elections and ram through their radical agenda. The memo added, Leader McConnell and Senate Republicans have repeatedly stood up to the left and their big lie that there is some evil anti-voting conspiracy sweeping America. Here is Senator McConnell in his Leader Time remarks.
The Senate Democratic leaders are trying to use a big lie to bully and berate their own members into breaking their word, breaking the rules, and breaking the Senate. We're going to spend all week sounding the alarm on the radical takeovers that some Democrats want to pull off. They want to silence millions of Americans and take over the Senate so they can take over elections, so they can take over America. Leading Democrats say they want to break the Senate because of a sinister anti-voting plot that is sweeping America. Of course, this is totally fake. It does not exist. The current control of Congress and the White House were decided in 2020 by the highest turnout in 120 years. 94% of voters said voting was easy. More Americans say current voting laws are too lax than say they are too restrictive. Confronted by the facts, the Democratic leader says they're, of course, irrelevant. He says the entire nuclear push is occasioned by what a few states did in 2021. This is utter nonsense. The senator from New York has been publicly laying groundwork to nuke the Senate rules since back in 2019, before the 2020 election. More than a year before the 2020 election, the Democratic leader was openly flirting with nuking the Senate rules if he got the power, so he'd be able to ram through bigger changes. Now, none of this was occasioned by what state legislatures did in 2021. This is actually a years-long quest for power in search of a pretext. And their hysterical attacks on state laws are fake as well. The state of Georgia passed a voting law providing for more in-person early voting than New York provides. It allows for no-excuse absentee voting, which New York prohibits. If there was not a voting crisis in Democratic-run New York 6 months ago, there's no crisis in Georgia now.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell during his Leader Time remarks on the Senate floor. With more on the congressional agenda this week, we spoke to Zach Cohen of Bloomberg Government.
So the House and Senate are back in session at the same time for the first time of the year. The Senate was in last week, and the House is just coming into session for the first time of the year today. Not a lot of action happening in the House. They'll vote on some legislation related to NASA and veterans issues, important issues, but not exactly headline news. The real action is over still in the Senate, where Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is hoping to bring up and at least consider legislation reforming the nation's elections, and in order to sort of get that done, some form of a rules change, because Republicans are opposed to all of the elections bills that Democrats have put forward at this juncture. Democrats are looking at a change to Senate rules that would somehow get them over a Republican filibuster. Not exactly clear what the options for that are yet, but we're hoping to see a little more detail over the course of the week.
Is that the focus for the Democratic Party this week? President Biden heading to Georgia, talking about voting rights?
It's all voting rights this week. As you mentioned, President Biden's in Georgia talking about it. And ahead of the Martin Luther King holiday, Schumer has made that a deadline of sorts to try to get something done. Democrats have brought up elections bills in the past. There's two of them. The Freedom to Vote Act, which is sort of a smaller version of the For the People Act that Democrats have been trying to get passed for years now. And then there's the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, which would restore parts of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, especially the preclearance provisions that were struck down by the Supreme Court. Both of those bills have been brought up for votes, have not gotten the 60 votes necessary to get over a Republican filibuster in the Senate. And so Democrats are looking at new ways to try to get around that blockade.
What is the update on the president's so-called Build Back Better agenda and Senator Joe Manchin?
Right. So listeners might remember that shortly before the holiday recess, Senator Manchin got on Fox News and basically said, I can't vote for this bill as written. Now, that being said, you know, there are parts of it that hadn't been written even at that juncture, hadn't even come to the floor of the Senate. But Manchin, and as well as Senator Kyrsten Sinema and all other 48 Senate Democrats, have been involved in lengthy negotiations amongst each other with the White House, trying to find some way forward for this roughly $1.7 trillion care economy climate change package. And it doesn't seem like there's been much movement since then. Speaker Pelosi is saying she still thinks there's a path forward. There are certainly leadership is very interested in trying to get a bill done, especially with the upcoming State of the Union that's been scheduled for President Biden to once again address a joint session of Congress on March 1st. But it doesn't really seem like there's been much negotiation on that front. So in the meantime, while Build Back Better negotiations are somewhat on the back burner, Democrats in the Senate have really pivoted toward a voting rights debate.
Well, with the numbers that we're seeing with the Omicron variant, you know, average daily cases around 700,000, Dr. Fauci saying you could see a million. How is any of that impacting Capitol Hill and how operations and how they plan to do their business?
So the Senate looks like it's really continuing as usual. One of my colleagues had asked Leader Schumer just last week, is there something that needs to be done differently? And Schumer essentially said, no, we'll continue masking. We'll continue making sure everybody's vaccinated. And the vaccination uptake rate, at least in the Senate, is pretty high. So that is not so much of an issue. But over in the House, they're going to make a couple of changes. They're really encouraging the use of proxy voting, essentially the practice of one lawmaker telling another how they're going to vote, and then that second lawmaker essentially declaring their vote on the floor. And this is something they've been doing for months now amid the COVID-19 pandemic. They're also asking that members not congregate on the floor. Obviously, 435 of them in one, albeit rather large, chamber is still a large indoor space with sort of mixed use of masking. And on top of that, the office of the attending physician, basically Congress's doctor, has said you all should be using N95 or KN95 masks because cloth masks really aren't sufficient for the amount of virality that we're seeing in the Omicron variant. And so certainly you might see some changes over in-house procedure, maybe holding votes open a little longer so that people can sort of come in and out rather than congregate on the floor. But there's really only so much they can do. A lot of what Congress does is in person. There's also maybe some hearings that could move to a virtual format. We're seeing that today. The Rules Committee is meeting in a virtual format as opposed to in person like they normally would in sort of a small office off the House floor. So certainly there are some changes they are making.
So when you talked about the Build Back Better agenda and Senator Joe Manchin and of course, his crucial vote, but how are House progressives reacting to the back and forth between the senators and the White House?
Well, certainly they're frustrated. They'd like to see some action on this bill, something they've been working on for months now. The issue, of course, is that not just Manchin and even Senator Kyrsten Sinema was sort of a key player in these talks, but it is sort of seen as a more likely yes vote at this juncture. But there are also parts of the bill that haven't been written yet. There's the state and local income deduction, basically the amount of money that federal taxpayers can take off of their federal income burden based on how much they paid at the state and local level. This is especially relevant in really high tax states or, you know, usually more Democratic-led states. And there hadn't really been a resolution on that front. You had negotiations with people like Senators Bernie Sanders and Bob Menendez who were sort of on opposite sides of, okay, who should really get this benefit at the end of the day? This is really an important issue for voters in Menendez's home state of New Jersey. Whereas Senator Sanders, obviously one of the more progressive members of the caucus, is much more interested in something making sure that, you know, multimillionaires don't get a chance to benefit from something like this. So there are certainly a number of issues that they have to work out. The really key issue at this point is whether they can get over the hump with the more moderate members.
So Zachary Cohen, all of this playing out with the election, the midterms election looming for lawmakers. What's the lay of the land right now and the odds of Democrats keeping their majority in the House and Senate?
So over in the House, and obviously both chambers are really, really narrow, and they have been the entire time Democrats have had power in Washington, at least since they got it back in early 2021. Over in the House, we're still waiting to see maps from a good chunk of the states. More than half of the states have drawn their new maps after once every decade redistricting. And so far, it seems to have shrunk the map a little bit. The number of competitive races is not quite as high as it could have been. And so that might benefit Democrats. But that being said, given President Biden's approval ratings being historically lower at this point than most other modern presidents, and given the sort of dissatisfaction with the direction of the country, that does tend to favor the out party, the minority in this case, that would benefit Republicans. So we'll see how the map shakes out. We'll see how some of these member races, especially among Democrats, could change which members are running in which districts. And then over in the Senate, you know, it's a little more staid. You know, you've got the states are not being redistricted, obviously. The real issue becomes, you know, who's raising more money. And especially for Republicans, because they're trying to field competitive candidates in places like Arizona and Georgia, you know, they're going to have to find candidates that are really compelling and can appeal to a general election audience. Not totally clear yet that they're able to do that. New Hampshire as well is another example.
And we learned just, you know, recently that Ron Johnson, Republican in Wisconsin, who said he was not going to seek a third term, has changed his mind. What was the calculation here?
Yeah, I remember talking to Ron Johnson all the way back in 2019. And, you know, Ron Johnson, when he first ran for the Senate in 2010, had said, look, I'm only going to seek two terms. That was something that was very important to him. It's something he reiterated when he ran for re-election in 2016. But when I talked to him in 2019, Democrats had taken over the House, and he basically told me, look, I wasn't really anticipating that. And if the Senate is sort of the firewall against Democratic policy, which obviously he doesn't like, then that might change his calculation. And obviously, as we saw this weekend, he has decided to seek a third term and, you know, laid out in a Wall Street Journal op-ed that he basically said what he's been saying to people like me and other reporters for a couple of years now is, if the Senate is the firewall against Democratic governance and there's a chance that Republicans could take the Senate again, then he saw it as his responsibility, opportunity, however you want to view it, to try to seek that seat. This is obviously a big win for Republicans, as Republicans would see it. Democrats actually would like to see him run again as well, because they see sort of his history on COVID-19 policy, fiscal policy, as being antithetical to where Wisconsinites are at. But Republicans love having an incumbent running. It helps with fundraising, it helps with name ID. And so that'll be a really marquee race to watch.
Why I'm seeking a third Senate term is the headline of Ron Johnson's piece in the Wall Street Journal this morning. He says, I'd like to retire, but I think the country is in too much peril. We also know that Senator John Thune of South Dakota is going to run for re-election. Zach Cohen, is that a surprise?
Not terribly. He's been sort of teasing this as a possibility for a while. It could have been that he was going to retire. It's something that I think there was some local reporting that his wife was interested in him retiring. And, you know, viewers might remember back in 2021, when the election results of 2020 were being certified for Joe Biden, Joe Biden's victory was being certified. A couple of reporters asked John Thune, you know, what is this objection going to do? And Thune responded, it's going to go down like a shot dog, I think is an exact quote. And obviously, then President Trump didn't really appreciate hearing that from the number two Republican in the Senate, and tried to get South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem to run in a primary against John Thune in South Dakota. Now, that hasn't played out. Noem has talked about running for re-election, and now Thune is as well. This is really important because Thune is viewed as one of the potential successors to Mitch McConnell as Republican leader in the Senate. In the event that eventually Mitch McConnell leaves the Senate, and it's, you know, John Thune, John Barrasso, John Cornyn, the John, if you will. And so that contest could be really important, and obviously Thune is looking to stick around for that.
Zach Cohen, also this week, the former majority and minority leader for the Democratic Party, Harry Reid, he's held both of those positions. The senator passed away recently. Tell us what will happen this week in the Capitol.
So Harry Reid's funeral in Las Vegas was this weekend. President Obama, President Biden, Leader Schumer, and Speaker Pelosi all spoke at that funeral. And now Leader Reid will lie in state in the Capitol, which is a rather rare honor, albeit a little more normal, a little more common than usual nowadays. And so his body will lie in state in the Capitol Rotunda on the catafalque, or the sort of standing that was used when for Lincoln's body after he was assassinated. And he'll be there for a couple of hours on Wednesday. And I expect we'll see a few more memorial remarks for the former Democratic Senate Majority Leader, really the man who helped get Obama's legislative agenda through the Senate, the Affordable Care Act being the most high profile of that. So definitely an important moment for members of both parties to recognize. There were a couple of Republicans at his funeral in Las Vegas. I imagine we'll hear some more nice words from both sides of the aisle this week.
From this morning's Washington Journal, Bloomberg government reporter Zach Cohen. You're listening to Washington Today. Welcome back to Washington Today. Top diplomats from the U.S. and Russia met today in Geneva, Switzerland, with the U.S. and its NATO allies remaining concerned that Russia's military buildup near its border with Ukraine could lead to an invasion there. Russian officials have denied that's their intention, but are seeking assurances that Ukraine will never be admitted to NATO. Both sides made clear today that while they'll keep talking, they remain far apart on meeting each other's concerns. Here's Assistant Secretary of State Wendy Sherman, the lead American diplomat, speaking to reporters on a conference call.
The United States and Russia agree that a nuclear war can never be won and must never be fought. We have discussed this shared principle in past SSD meetings, and it was reaffirmed last week in a statement by the P5 nations. That is why the United States has long been interested in discussing with Russia options for arms control that include both strategic and so-called non-strategic nuclear weapons. We reiterated our interest in having deeper discussions on this topic during today's meetings as well. We were firm, however, in pushing back on security proposals that are simply non-starters for the United States. We will not allow anyone to slam closed NATO's open-door policy, which has always been central to the NATO alliance. We will not forego bilateral cooperation with sovereign states that wish to work with the United States. And we will not make decisions about Ukraine without Ukraine, about Europe without Europe, or about NATO without NATO. As we say to our allies and partners, nothing about you without you. The United States is committed to meaningful, reciprocal dialogue with Russia, just as we are committed to consulting and coordinating with our allies and partners. We are ready to continue discussions on the bilateral issues we identified today as soon as practical, and we made that clear. We will have discussions with our allies and partners in the days ahead, and at the end of this week, informed by those discussions, the U.S. and Russian governments will discuss the way forward.
As many as 100,000 Russian soldiers have massed near the Ukrainian border, and the U.S. is prepared to impose a range of economic penalties on Russia should it move to invade Ukraine. Here's more from Deputy Secretary Sherman on those sanctions, responding to a question from NBC News Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent Andrea Mitchell.
Could you talk about the kind of sanctions that you're talking about more broadly? There's been a very detailed explanation by our colleagues at the New York Times over the weekend. Are we talking about the SWIFT system? Are we talking about export-import controls on key sectors? Could you be a little bit more specific about what Russia would face if they ignore the diplomatic track? Thank you so much.
So, Andrea, what we said is if Russia further invades Ukraine, there will be significant costs and consequences well beyond what happened in 2014. We are very ready and aligned with our partners and allies to impose those severe costs. You've seen statements from NATO, from the G7, from the European Council. We are very well aligned. Those costs will include financial sanctions. And it's been reported those sanctions will include key financial institutions, export controls that target key industries, enhancements of NATO force posture on allied territory, and increased security assistance to Ukraine. I'm not going to go into any more specific detail, Andrea, although I understand why you'd like it, because we want to make sure that these have impact. They cannot all be anticipated by Russia if we have to impose them, and that they will have the consequences that we know that they can have.
But to be precise, could I ask a follow-up about what you mean by increased support to Ukraine? Do you mean the Ukraine's government and Ukraine militia groups?
I'm talking about security assistance to Ukraine. As you know, we've already provided some security assistance. We continue to do so, and we would increase it, and it's not just the United States. There are all other governments in Europe who are providing security assistance to Ukraine.
Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman talking to NBC News Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent Andrea Mitchell earlier today on a conference call. Monday's talks were the first of three sets of meetings on tap for this week between Russia, the U.S., and its European partners. The House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol has accused Representative Jim Jordan of backtracking on his commitment to cooperate after the Ohio Republican said Sunday he would refuse to voluntarily appear before the panel. In a statement, the committee spokesperson said, Mr. Jordan has previously said that he would cooperate with the committee's investigation, but it now appears that the Trump team has persuaded him to try to hide the facts and circumstances of January 6th. The committee asked Representative Jordan last month to meet about the communications he had with former President Trump on the January 6th attack. Representative Jordan previously said he has, quote, nothing to hide about his actions surrounding January 6th. But in a letter to Committee Chair Benny Thompson on Sunday, Representative Jordan called the request to meet a, quote, unprecedented and inappropriate demand. Jim Jordan is one of the three people the committee has recently asked for voluntary cooperation in its investigation. The other two are Fox News host Sean Hannity and Pennsylvania Republican Scott Perry. According to campaign finance records, the Republican National Committee spent $3 million from September to November defending former President Trump in court. That includes the criminal investigations into his New York businesses, and that money comes from donors. According to Brandon Fisher, federal reforms director at the Nonpartisan Campaign Legal Center, it's unprecedented for a national political party to cover a former president's private legal bills, especially when they come from an investigation into activity before the president was in the White House. And with speculation about Donald Trump running again in 2024 and the federal investigation continuing into the January 6th attack on the Capitol, South Dakota Republican Senator Mike Rounds said he believes the federal courts should decide the former president's fate over his role in allegedly inciting the attacks.
Every single individual in the United States is subject to the court systems. What happens with a president is that he has the shield of office, which in many cases prohibits or limits the ability of the courts to address issues surrounding that. What an impeachment does is take away that shield. President Trump was no longer president at the time that that occurred. The courts are the appropriate place where those questions should be answered. This is not going to be up to members of the United States Senate or the House, in my opinion. I think this is an issue which the courts can decide, and most certainly if there is evidence there, this is going to be up to the Justice Department to bring it forward and to move with it. But once again, every single person has protections under that system. The former president has protections under that system as well. But this is something that should be decided in the courts. And I don't think it's something that we should be legislating on right now.
So just to be clear then, if the Department of Justice comes forward with evidence that President Trump was indeed complicit, more evidence that President Trump was complicit, you'd support prosecution?
In this particular case, it's not going to be up to a member of the Senate to support prosecution. What it's going to be is it's up to the Justice Department to make that decision. And every single person who is accused of a crime is considered innocent until proven guilty. We all know that. The same thing with a former president. So if they think they've got that, they can bring the evidence forward. In my opinion, they haven't done that yet, and it's going to be up to them to make that case. But that shield of the presidency does not exist for someone who is a former president. Everybody, you, me, everybody in this country is subject to the courts of this country.
Separately, could you support President Trump if he runs again?
I'm sorry?
Could you support President Trump if he runs again?
I'll take a hard look at it. Personally, what I've told people is I'm going to support the Republican nominee to be president. I'm not sure that the eventual nominee has even shown up yet. There's still over 2 years to go. We're going to focus on the the next election cycle. It's critical that we take back the House. It's critical that we take back the United States Senate. And doing, and based upon that, then we'll decide who our nominee for president is going to be.
South Dakota Republican Senator Mike Rounds yesterday on ABC News This Week program. Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson said Sunday he's running for re-election, breaking a campaign pledge to serve only two terms. Senator Johnson revealed his decision in a two-paragraph statement and a larger opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal that read in part, quote, "I believe America is in peril. As much as I'd like to ease into a quiet retirement, I don't feel I should." He acknowledged making his two-term pledge during the 2016 campaign, but said he and his wife Jane didn't anticipate the, quote, "Democrats' complete takeover of government and the disastrous policies they have inflicted on America and the world." Senator Johnson is seen as the best chance Republicans have of holding on to the seat. President Biden narrowly won Wisconsin in 2020, and all statewide offices there are currently held by Democrats. Colorado Democratic Representative Ed Perlmutter announced that he won't seek re-election in 2022. He said in a statement, quote, "I never shied away from a challenge, but it's time for me to move on and explore other opportunities. There comes a time when you pass the torch to the next generation of leaders." The 68-year-old Democrat was first elected to Congress in 2006. He represents Colorado's 7th District, which was redrawn this year as part of the state's redistricting process. The Cook Political Report still ranks it as solid Democrat. For millions of Americans in the 1990s, he starred as everyone's TV dad, playing the role of Danny Tanner on Full House. He also hosted America's Funniest Home Videos, which was a precursor to YouTube. Actor and comedian Bob Saget was found unresponsive yesterday in his hotel room after performing a comedy show in Orlando, Florida. On March 19, 1995, he appeared at a Capitol Hill rally on child nutrition programs, where he was introduced by House Democratic leader Richard Gephardt.
Now, I don't know about your household on Sunday nights, but in mine, we have a tradition. My kids like to watch a television show that has a lot of funny things on it, people falling down and looking silly. It's called America's Funniest Home Videos, and we have the star of that show as our MC, Bob Saget.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Roosevelt, Mr. Truman, Mr. Washington, Mr. Lincoln. Everyone, thank you. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Thank you, Congressman Gephardt, for your very kind words. That was very nice. To be associated with people falling down brings me a lot of joy. I am very pleased to be here with all of you. Very, very pleased. And very pleased to be here with all these great kids that are up here right now. And they deserve a round of applause because look how good they are. My kids would never sit here this long. I never thought when I was in school, elementary school, that I would one day be defending the cafeteria lady. The lady with the mashed potatoes, the food I sometimes, heaven, just God forgive me, I mixed it together. The little ice cream with the wooden spoon. I got a splinter in my teeth, not unlike George Washington, the father of our country. And I am here today to defend chili con carne, pizza, and whatever good nutrition you can get for $1.50.
Actor-comedian Bob Saget in his lone C-SPAN appearance. You can see more from that event at cspan.org and on our free mobile app, C-SPAN Now. Bob Saget was 65. President Biden, Vice President Harris, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, former President Barack Obama, and hundreds of others gathered in a downtown Las Vegas theater on Saturday to pay tribute to the late Senator Harry Reid. Speaker Pelosi, in her words, remembered the former Nevada senator as a fearless, strategic, knowledgeable legislator who never forgot his mission of fighting for working families.
For the 12 years we served together as leaders in our respected houses, I had the privilege of seeing his mastery firsthand, rescuing American families with the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, protecting hardworking consumers with the Dodd-Frank reforms, and championing the passage of the Affordable Care Act, just to name a few, under the leadership of President Barack Obama and Vice President Joe Biden. When he retired, and we would no longer be speaking constantly on the phone, he came to my office This was when he announced his retirement. He said, "Nancy, I have something for you to remember me by." I thought it might be a handwritten note or a special photo. Instead, he unveiled a massive bald eagle, stuffed, but the wings still capable of fluttering in the breeze. Shocked, I said, "Harry, did you go hunting and kill an endangered species?" He said, "No, he died flying into a power line, and I called him Sparky." Whether symbolic of his patriotism with the bald eagle, his environmentalism, or his dry sense of humor, and dry it was, it is one of the finest and most curious gifts I've ever received, and a subject of great question in the Speaker's office. Today, this majestic bird has flown from the Senate leader's office over to the Speaker's office, appropriately and with his permission, now called Harry.
President Biden also spoke at the event. He served with Senator Reid in the Senate. He said Harry Reid's rise from poverty in the small town of Searchlight, Nevada, to the U.S. Senate is proof that ordinary Americans can accomplish anything.
Over five decades, we became genuine friends. The Irish Catholic kid from Scranton, Pennsylvania, and the Latter-day Saint from Searchlight. You think I'm kidding? But Harry's like the guys I grew up with back in Scranton and Claymont, Delaware. Harry would always have your back, like the guys I grew up with. Harry had mine, and he knew I had his. Although I sometimes wondered, when I was trying to make an important point to Harry about whether he really did have my back as he hung up. But to tell the truth, every time he would do it, I knew it was real, the real Harry. It was him. He had all he needed. He didn't want any more or need any more. And we did share some similarities. As Barack said, we have loving families, wives that are smarter and better looking than we were. And Harry and I both like to talk a lot. I'm just testing whether you're asleep yet. But whether you served with Harry for decades or you were new to America just a few days ago, you wanted Harry in your corner, and that's not hyperbole. His toughness was distinctly Nevada. His story was unmistakably American. His remarkable journey has been told by so many, because it has been traveled by so few. The desert shack he called home, miles to hitchhike to school, a boxing ring where he always got up, family tragedies endured, the cancer he and Londra fought, the halls of power he walked, the state he transformed, the country he shaped. He was proof that there's nothing ordinary about America. That ordinary Americans can do anything given half a chance.
Senator Harry Reid died on December 28th at the age of 82 after a four-year battle with cancer, and he will lie in state at the U.S. Capitol this Wednesday, January 12th, starting at 10:30 a.m. You can see that entire memorial service, which includes performances by Brandon Flowers of The Killers and singer-songwriter Carole King, on our website at cspan.org and also on the free C-SPAN Now mobile app. And that's where you can also find this program if you missed any of it. You can also go to cspan.org/podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you'd like more on the stories that are shaping Washington delivered right to your inbox daily, you can subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, word for word. Just go to cspan.org/connect to subscribe. I'm Gary Sterkoff. Thanks a lot for listening today to Washington Today.